This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The number of COVID-19 related deaths climbed by about 6,000 within 24 hours globally to approximately 578,000. The figure is more than 136,000 in the United States. There are more than 13 million confirmed infections globally and more than 3.4 million in the U.S. Researchers revealed that the first COVID-19 vaccine tested in the United States revved up people's immune systems just the way scientists had hoped, as the shots are poised to begin key final testing. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the U.S. government's top infectious disease expert, told the Associated Press, no matter how you slice this, this is good news. The experimental vaccine developed by Fauci's colleagues at the National Institutes of Health and Moderna Incorporated will start its most important step around July 27th, a 30,000-person study to prove if the shots really are strong enough to protect against the coronavirus. But Tuesday, researchers reported anxiously awaited findings from the first 45 volunteers who rolled up their sleeves back in March. The U.S. state of Florida has surpassed its daily record for coronavirus deaths on Tuesday, amid rising global worries of a resurgence, even as researchers announced that the first vaccine tested in the U.S. had worked to boost patients' immune systems. Florida's 132 additional deaths topped a state mark set just last week. The figure likely includes deaths from the past weekend that had not been previously reported. The new deaths raised the state's seven-day average to 81 per day, more than double the figure of 2 weeks ago, and now the second highest in the United States behind Texas. This is VOA News. As the heated debate about whether U.S. kids should return to school within weeks while the COVID-19 cases continue to soar, Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has told VOA he is absolutely comfortable with the idea of U.S. students returning to school this fall, despite the rising rates of coronavirus infections. Speaking to Greta Van Susteren on her VOA show Plugged In, Redfield also said he's expecting the pandemic to cost the United States between $5 and $7 trillion. He also added that the spectrum of illness for COVID-19 is one of the largest that medical experts have seen, meaning some people can have the virus and be asymptomatic while others become critically ill. U.S. President Donald Trump signed legislation in an executive order Tuesday that he said will hold China accountable for its oppressive actions against the people of Hong Kong, then quickly shifted his policy speech into a political one, hurling broadsides against Democratic rival Joe Biden. The legislation and order are part of the Trump administration's stepped-up offensive against China for what he calls the rising Asian superpowers' attacks on Beijing and exploitation of America and its effort to conceal details about the human-to-human transmission of the coronavirus from the world. The almost daily administration attacks on Beijing come as Mr. Trump defends his own response to the virus, with cases surging in parts of the U.S. A U.S. judge denied bail for Ghislaine Maxwell, Jeffrey Epstein's longtime associate, who has been accused of allegedly luring young girls to the late financier so that he could sexually abuse them. The 58-year-old Maxwell, appearing by video from a Brooklyn, New York jail, pleaded not guilty to 6 criminal charges. That's 4 related to transporting minors for illegal sexual acts and 2 for perjury. Prosecutors had argued Maxwell was an extreme flight risk. The judge agreed, saying Maxwell demonstrated sophistication in hiding her resources and herself. Israeli police arrested at least 50 people in the aftermath of a protest against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem. Police deployed mounted officers and water cannons to disperse protesters who blocked roads and set fire to trash bins in the city center after a demonstration outside Netanyahu's residence. Protesters who had gathered hours earlier were demanding his resignation over what they say has been an inept government response to the coronavirus crisis, as a corruption trial in which Netanyahu faces charges in 3 cases that include bribery, breach of trust, and fraud. via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi police arrest former President Mutharika's aide for alleged corruption.
You know, when government changes, you should expect such kind of things to happen. They want to do the checks and balance and probably doing the audit of how the previous government has been transacting their businesses.
Libya's eastern-based parliament calls for Egypt's intervention if security is threatened. A war crimes trial has begun against a Malian jihadist leader. UN investigators are skeptical about new Burundi leaders' reform promises. And 41 health workers at a Kenyan maternity hospital test positive for coronavirus.
Out of the 290 who are tested, 41 found positive. All these 41 have been on home-based isolation because majority of our people are still asymptomatic.
And Sudanese women welcome their freedom to travel abroad with their children without permission from their husbands. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Police in Malawi have arrested a bodyguard of former President Peter Mutharika for allegedly helping him avoid nearly $7 million in import duties. Mutharika has denied knowledge of the scheme, which saw cement for construction of his private property imported duty-free. Lamek Masina has the story from Blantyre.
Norman Chisal is one of several people whom police arrested Tuesday for alleged involvement in the cement importation deal. Police spokesperson James Kadadzera confirmed the arrest, but refused further comment to avoid jeopardizing the investigation. He spoke via a messaging app.
So I'm not in a position now to give out details as far as the issues surrounding the arrest are concerned.
Kadadzera, however, says besides Jisale, police are interrogating several other people on the matter. On a Friday, police arrested the former Deputy Commissioner General of the Malawi Revenue Authority, Rosa Mbilizi, for facilitating the importation of the duty-free cement. Records show that the MRIA gave Mutharika the clearance to make the duty-free cement importations in three tranches, with each consignment valued at $2.24 million. Former President Mutharika has denied knowing about the scheme, but a businessman implicated in the deal, Ahmed Chunala, told police that the imports were initiated by the State House officials. The arrests are part of an anti-corruption crackdown initiated after Mutharika lost the June 23rd presidential election and new President Lazarus Chakwera took office. Mutharika's Democratic Progressive Party, now in the opposition, says the campaign amounts to political persecution. Political analyst Sherif Kaisi says the arrests were expected. He spoke via a messaging app.
You know, when government changes, you should expect such kind of things to happen. They want to do the checks and balance and probably doing the audit of how the previous government has been transacting their businesses.
Chisale is expected to appear in court to face charges Wednesday. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Kenya's Ministry of Health says at least 41 employees at the country's largest maternity hospital have tested positive for the coronavirus. The announcement on Tuesday comes as Kenya's healthcare providers called for adequate personal protective equipment. Rael Ombuol reports from Nairobi.
Director General of Health, Dr. Patrick Amoth, announced Tuesday that 19 healthcare workers and 22 support staff have tested positive for the coronavirus at the Pumwani Maternity Hospital in Nairobi. The Ministry of Health had conducted mass testing at the facilities where more than 100 babies are born each month. After visiting the facility Tuesday, Dr. Amoth says the government was putting in place measures to stop further spread of the virus.
There's a remaining batch of about 100 staff members to be tested. Out of the 290 who are tested, 41 turned positive. All these 41 have been on home-based isolation. They qualify for home-based isolation because majority of our people are still asymptomatic. 90% of the infections we get in our setup are asymptomatic. Therefore, that gives us a very good platform to be able to implement home-based care intervention.
With the increase in coronavirus cases in the country, access to safe healthcare has been a challenge to both those seeking the services and healthcare providers. Kenya's Ministry of Health in the last week announced that 257 healthcare workers had tested positive. On Monday, Kenya buried the first doctor to succumb to the ailment. The coronavirus causes the COVID-19 disease. Since the pandemic hit Kenya in March, the country's doctors and the nurses' union have threatened several times to go on strike, saying the government is not doing enough to provide protective gear to healthcare workers on the coronavirus front lines, especially in public health facilities. Even as testing continues, it is not clear how many babies may have been exposed to the virus at Pumwani or how the government plans to trace those who may have been exposed to the confirmed cases. According to the Johns Hopkins University COVID-19 dashboard, Kenya currently has nearly 10,300 confirmed cases and 197 deaths. Dr. Amoth said the government is putting in efforts to mitigate the crisis.
We have agreed that beginning today, we'll have an isolation center dedicated for staff of the hospital at the School of Nursing for those who may not meet the criteria for home-based isolation. So basically, ours is a mission of support and also fact-finding to help see what is on the ground and to assure the public that we are doing everything possible.
Amoth said Pumwani Hospital is safe. He did, however, say in a tweet that the facility would only be open for complicated delivery cases. He advised patients to access maternal health care services from other nearby facilities. Rael Ombur for VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations Commission of Inquiry on Burundi is doubting that promises of reform made by Burundi's newly elected president will result in hoped-for improvements in the country's human rights situation. The commission has submitted its report on prevailing conditions in the country to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The three-member panel welcomes promises of political reconciliation, judicial reform, and protection of the population made by Burundi's newly elected president, Evariste Ndayishimiye, in his inaugural address. But the chair of the UN Commission, Dudu Dien, says the president's comments were full of ambiguities and contradictions. For example, he notes the president's remarks seem to justify the imposition of restrictions on some public liberties, such as freedom of expression, information, and assembly, under the guise of preserving Burundian culture. He speaks on a video link from Paris through an interpreter.
Such remarks are concerning, especially given that the new president's policies will be implemented by a government composed primarily of the old guard of the late President Nkurunziza's regime, some of whom are under sanctions for their involvement in grave human rights violations.
President Pierre Nkurunziza died of cardiac arrest on June 8th after a brief hospitalization while his wife was in Kenya undergoing medical treatment. A number of news outlets report he died of the coronavirus. Commission Chair Dien says gross, widespread human rights violations continue in Burundi and that it would be premature to make any pronouncements on the possible evolution of the situation under the new government. Again, he speaks through an interpreter.
We solemnly urge the new President of the Republic to demonstrate his willingness for change by fully cooperating with the international human rights mechanisms. The immediate release of the four journalists of Iwacu, of human rights defenders, would be a significant gesture of this.
Iwacu is one of the few remaining private media organizations in Burundi. In January, the journalists were sentenced to 2.5 years in prison after being convicted on charges of trying to undermine state security. Last October, the Committee to Protect Journalists said the four were arrested while covering unrest triggered by a clash between Burundian security forces and gunmen who had entered the country from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Burundi's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Renaud Vagabou, rejects the commission's report. He accuses the commission of interfering in the domestic affairs of his country and of slandering and insulting public authorities with the blessing of the UN Council. He calls that a flagrant violation of the UN Charter and reaffirms his country's refusal to cooperate with the commission. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The former chief of Timbuktu's Islamic Police went on trial Tuesday in The Hague for a number of alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity charges, including rape, sexual slavery, and destroying irreplaceable shrines in the ancient Malian city. Lisa Bryant has the story from Paris.
Chef numéro 9, esclavage sexuel.
Wearing a flowing blue gown and white headdress and a face mask pushed below his nose, Al-Hassan Ag Abdulaziz Ag Mohammed Ag Mahmoud replied yes to whether he understood each of the 13 charges against him. But on each count, he refused to plead either innocent or guilty. International Criminal Court prosecutors accuse Al-Hassan of rape, torture, and sexual slavery, among other atrocities allegedly committed between 2012 and 2013 as Timbuktu's police chief after jihadists occupied the city.
Aujourd'hui commence le procès tant attendu.
Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda described as unimaginable the crimes committed by jihadists in the city. Under Al-Hassan, she said, the Islamic police belittled, humiliated, and persecuted residents on religious grounds. Prosecutors argue Al-Hassan abused, whipped, and tortured Timbuktu residents who violated strict religious laws. He allegedly forced young women and girls to marry jihadist fighters, which the prosecution claims led to rape and sexual enslavement. And he is accused of participating in lashings of men and women and of playing a role in the destruction of local shrines. Al-Hassan's defense argues he is not mentally fit to stand trial.
How can somebody who is experiencing such post-traumatic stress that they are dissociating in a way that they avoid memories properly assist counsel in analyzing the evidence that to date it still has not had the opportunity to even investigate in order to prepare an adequate defense?
ICC judges ruled Al-Hassan to be medically examined, but ruled the opening would not be delayed. Al-Hassan is the second Islamist to face trial at the ICC over the destruction of Timbuktu's religious and historical buildings. In 2016, Ahmed El-Faqih Al-Mahdi pled guilty to attacks on the UNESCO World Heritage Site. He was sentenced to 9 years in prison. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
As tensions between Libya's two rival governments and their international backers continue to worsen, the Eastern Libya-based parliament has authorized Egypt to intervene militarily if the security of either country is threatened. At the same time, the Speaker of the Eastern Parliament is calling for the UN to continue its mediation efforts. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Arab media broadcast video of Syrian militia fighters training near the Libyan capital Tripoli amid claims that Turkey has sent more mercenaries to Libya to support the UN-backed government of Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj. Libya's eastern-based parliament issued a statement late Monday authorizing Egypt, which supports the rival government of Abdullah al-Thani and Baida, to intervene militarily if necessary due to what it called Turkey's blatant intervention in Libya and breaching of the country's sovereignty. Libyan parliament spokesman Abdullah Blaihak, on a visit to Cairo Monday, thanked Egypt for helping his country. He says he thanked the Egyptian parliament for its support for Libya's security and stability in all areas, given that the security of both countries are intertwined and that the ties between them are long-standing. Despite the Eastern Libyan Parliament's authorization of a potential Egyptian military intervention in Libya, in the event either country's security is threatened, Parliament Speaker Akila Saleh told Arab media that he has asked the UN to continue mediating in the Libya conflict.
He says that during his recent visit several days ago to the UN in Geneva, he asked Deputy UN Envoy Stephanie Williams to continue efforts to find a solution to the Libyan conflict that suits each side and coincides with previous talks in Cairo and Berlin. Egyptian General Mahmoud Zahar told Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV he thinks Turkey is playing a game of nerves with Libya and Egypt, and that ultimately Ankara's goal is to cause the division of the country. Libyan analyst Aya Burwaila, a visiting lecturer on security and terrorism at the Hellenic National Defense College in Greece, told VOA she thinks the Libyan parliament's authorization for Egypt to intervene should make it nearly impossible for Turkey and its Syrian proxies to capture Libya's strategic oil crescent. She called the conflict an existential crisis for both Egypt and Libya, since neither can allow Libya to become a failed state, exploited by what she calls Turkish political and military proxies, which include militant jihadists and organized crime networks. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, told VOA, however, that he worries the Libyan parliament's declaration could lead to a conflict because mistakes are made when things are this heated. He also questions if Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan might not take the warning as a challenge. Turkey, inspired largely by its energy interests in Libya, has been boosting its role in the Libyan conflict, saying it is doing so in support of the internationally recognized government in Tripoli. Its expanding role is also raising concerns of what analysts say could be the start of a proxy war. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Cameroon doctors say they are fighting to stop a cholera outbreak that has sickened over 400 people and claimed 56 lives this month in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic. The outbreak of the waterborne disease has underscored a lack of sanitation and clean water in some areas that may also help spread the coronavirus. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Christine Oro Ekedi, a medical officer in the southern coastal town of Kribi, says reported cases of cholera have been increasing by the day. She says the hospital staff is overwhelmed attending to COVID-19 and cholera patients. She says within the past 1 month, 7 of the 11 hospitals in her council area have reported increasing cases of people suffering from cholera. She says it has not been easy for medical staff to attend to cases of COVID-19 and cholera at the same time. She says they are, however, advising all citizens to rush to the nearest hospital when they notice that they have diarrhea. Ekedi said it was difficult for medical staff to access the villages hit by the cholera outbreak. She said at least 22,000 people from Cameroon, Gabon, Nigeria, and Equatorial Guinea who live along the coastal area are at risk. This week, Cameroon's Ministry of Health reported that at least 400 people have been diagnosed with cholera in the coastal towns of Douala and Kribi and surrounding villages. 56 lives have been lost. Flavin Tutum, mayor of Kribi's second district, says lack of proper sanitation and clean water is helping to spread the disease.
Il faut délocaliser les pêcheurs de l'Orge. Mes équipes sont sur le terrain en ce moment.
Tutum says she has ordered her council staff to disinfect all contaminated streams, wells, and water sources. She says the council has warned civilians against using streams as toilets. She says she will, in the days ahead, forcefully relocate people from areas along the shore already infested by dirty sea water. The villagers along the coast generally lack clean water. Kribi resident Rosette Keddy says they rely on sea and stream water for their daily needs, and quite often, some community members use the sea and stream as toilets. She says they have waited in vain to be provided with drinkable water the government promised when COVID-19 started spreading in their village 3 months ago. She says villagers have been abandoned and are on their own despite the COVID-19 threat and cholera spread. She says the nearest drinkable water source is 3 kilometers from her home. Health officials say they have deployed medical teams and aid workers to the affected areas to teach civilians to respect basic hygiene norms. The health ministry says civilians should boil water before drinking, wash hands often with soap, use latrines or bury feces, and should not defecate in any body of water. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
In Sudan, divorced mother Mahaya Hamein's years-long struggle with her ex-husband's control over their children took a drastic turn when her father, who lived in the United States, was diagnosed with cancer. Hamein wanted her one-year-old daughter to meet her grandfather before he died. But under Sudan's laws, her ex-husband was able to stop her. Sudan's transitional government amended the law last week to allow women to travel abroad with their children without their father's permission, a move welcomed by women's rights groups. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
30-year-old divorced mother Manaya Hamid recalls how her ex-husband continued to torment her using Sudan's laws even after their marriage ended. In 2015, she wanted to take her one-year-old daughter to meet her grandfather, who was living in the United States and dying of cancer. But under Sudan's Muslim Personal Law Act of 1991, only the father could decide if his child was allowed to travel abroad, even if he was a former husband. Hamid's former husband would not allow it, and fearing that he might disappear with the child, she stayed in Sudan. Her father died in 2017. But last week, Sudan's transitional government amended several laws on personal freedom, allowing women to travel abroad with their children without the father's permission. Hamid says when she heard the new amendments regarding the Personal Law Act, she cried a lot. Remembering all of her divorce, she congratulates all Sudanese mothers who suffered and couldn't travel freely. Under the 1991 law, women in Sudan also require the consent of their husband or a male guardian to travel outside the country. Rights groups welcomed the changes and noted the conflict with Sudan's constitution, which guarantees freedom of religion and says women should be treated equally under the law. Women's rights activist Shahinaz Jamal says the amendment was long overdue. She says the legal change is a step forward and a result of great efforts and struggles by all Sudanese women. They need more achievements to be fulfilled, says Jamal, but also welcome this step and see it's a big victory. Legal expert Mohamed Makki says the amendments are a welcome change after decades of abuse under the laws during the rule of ousted former President Omar al-Bashir. He says amending the Personal Law Act is definitely a victory for the majority of Sudanese people who suffered legally under the former regime. But he notes lawyers like himself hope to see civilian authorities like the Legislative Council making the legal changes, as they represent the Sudanese people. Sudan's Justice Minister announced the legal changes Saturday. They included criminalizing female genital mutilation, decriminalizing drinking alcohol for non-Muslims, and removing the death penalty for Muslims who convert. Naba Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
And that's it for this Wednesday, July 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues.
It's about listening to them
and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local